This is Barbara Ridenour with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated March 17, 2017, St. Patrick's Day. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with Catholics Stick with Fish. Decatur Catholics Sticking to Fish on St. Patrick's Day. When Springfield Bishop Thomas John Pepperocki didn't grant a diocese-wide dispensation from the Lenten abstinence from meat for St. Patrick's Day, it didn't bother Maggie Pugh. Corned beef and cabbage is the customary meal for the Irish American on St. Patrick's Day. And this year, for the first time since 2006, St. Patrick's Day fell on a Friday during Lent, a period from Ash Wednesday to Easter, in which all Catholics 14 and older must abstain from meat on Fridays. Local bishops are allowed to make dispensations, and several around the country have. Springfield's past bishop did in 2006, but Pepperocki didn't relent, so Irish Catholics shouldn't eat corned beef today. Pugh of Decatur is Catholic and said everyone has a little Irish, though admitted her ancestry has more German. She said most of her friends and family already ate corned beef and cabbage last Saturday on the day of the Decatur St. Patrick's Day parade and won't miss it today. We always tend to have a big celebration at the KC Hall, Knights of Columbus Hall, the Saturday before, Pugh said. We'll have corned beef then. But we usually don't do corned beef on the actual day, whether it falls on a Monday or a Friday. Doherty's Pub and Pins co-owner John Hawkins said he sold a lot of corned beef and cabbage last Saturday and plans to today as well. We'll do a good business. It's one of our biggest days. And a lot of people will eat corned beef, Hawkins said. Some of the Catholics will order fish, but a lot of them will say, it's St. Patrick's Day. I'm eating corned beef. I mean, it's St. Patty's Day. You wear green, eat corned beef and cabbage, drink green beer, and have fun. The Main Hangar restaurant is having all-you-can-eat corned beef and cabbage today, Saturday, and during its Sunday brunch buffet. Owner Stephanie Cooper said that the Main Hangar also has an all-you-can-eat walleye on Fridays. Let us hit people who want corned beef and the ones who can't eat it, Cooper said, and we have other fish items on the menu too. While some Catholics ignore Lent and others will make their own dispensation, Carrie Peters of Decatur said Lent overrides the tradition of St. Patrick's Day. I'll eat fish, that's what I do, and I've always done on Fridays during Lent, Peters said. If St. Patrick's Day fell on another day, I might celebrate in the traditional sense and have corned beef and cabbage. But since it falls on Friday this year, I'll eat fish. Why corned beef? Eating corned beef and cabbage on St. Patrick's Day is a tradition that's been around for generations, but there's debate whether it's a true Irish tradition or an Irish-American tradition. According to KitchenProject.com, a website that looks at the history of different foods, the term corned comes from putting meat in a large crock and covering it with large rock salt kernels of salt that were referred to as corns of salt. The salt preserved the meat. Ireland was a great producer of corned beef for more than 200 years, beginning in the 1600s. Some historians say corned beef served with cabbage and potatoes were eaten in Ireland during holidays, weddings, and wakes, and was brought to the New World. Others say beef was too expensive for the average Irishman, and it was more common to celebrate holidays with ham or bacon, a bacon joint, a cured but unsmoked piece of pork, with cabbage and potatoes. And when Irish immigrants came to the U.S., they couldn't find a bacon joint, and they found that Jewish corned beef was similar in texture. City jobs report mixed. Stable unemployment in Decatur last January. Slight job losses and with a steady unemployment rate rang in Decatur's new year. The unemployment rate in the Decatur area was 7.7% in January, the same as it was 12 months earlier, according to Illinois Department of Employment Security Statistics, released Thursday. That number was up from 6.4% rate in December. Decatur had the fifth highest rate in Illinois in January, compared to Rockford's 11.1%, Danville's 8.6%, and Kankakee and Peoria's 8.3%. The job losses outside of the Chicago area continue to hamper overall statewide job growth, said Jeff Mays, the department's director. The city of Decatur's unemployment rate was 8.4%, up from January 2016's 8.1%, and 1.4 percentage points higher than the city's rate in December. This January saw a total of 50,500 non-farm jobs in the Decatur area, down 300 jobs from last year. There were payroll increases in the number of jobs in education and health services, which went up by 200 jobs, as well as financial activities, government and other services, which all saw an increase in 100 jobs. But those increases were offset by a loss of 300 jobs in construction and leisure and hospitality, and the loss of 100 jobs in manufacturing and retail. All other majority industry sectors were stable compared to last year. There were an estimated 3,900 unemployed people in the Decatur area labor force in January 2017. Several events will be held in the coming month to help connect people with jobs. Those include a job fair held from noon to 5 p.m. Tuesday, April 9th, at Richland Community College's Schilling Center Salons, and a two-day boot camp being held Wednesday and Thursday, April 10 and 11, to help applicants look for jobs and better prepare for job interviews. To reserve a spot at the boot camp, please call 217-875-8767. That's 875-8767. The unemployment rate varied in areas surrounding Decatur. The January unemployment rate in Christian County was 7.9%, the same as last year. DeWitt, 7.4%, and 6.9% a year ago. And Logan, 6.5% and 6.4%. In Moultrie, 5.7% and 5.3%. In Piatt, 6.3%, the same as last year. And in Shelby, 7.3% and 7%. Of the 14 Illinois metropolitan areas, only the Chicago, Quad Cities, and Metro East areas saw a decline in their unemployment rate in January compared to last year. More than half of the metropolitan areas saw a decrease in the number of non-farm jobs. The statewide unemployment rate was 6.5%, down from 6.7% a year ago, but still significantly above the national average of 4.8% in January. In states that border Illinois, the rates were Indiana 4.0, Missouri 4.2, Wisconsin 3.9, Iowa 3.3, Kentucky 5.0, and Michigan 5.2. Jury convicts Smith of shooting girlfriend's ex-husband. Decatur. After deliberating for almost 5 hours, a jury of 6 men and 6 women found Stephen D. Smith, 28, of Decatur, guilty of attempted first-degree murder and 2 other related felony charges. Smith, who reportedly expected to be acquitted, snapped his head downward when he heard the verdict, read aloud by Macon County Circuit Judge R.C. Bollinger at 3:25 p.m. Thursday. Smith sat at the defense table beside Assistant Public Defender Scott Reuter, dressed in a black sweater, blue jeans, and tan work boots. After the jurors were dismissed from the courtroom, 3 women sobbed and wailed in response to the verdict. One of Smith's female relatives tried to push her way past a correctional officer to leave the courtroom against the judge's order, which was for spectators to stay inside until jurors reached their vehicles. She was gently restrained until the courtroom received the report of the jurors' safe passage. Smith will be sentenced by Bollinger to serve a minimum of 31 years in prison at a hearing scheduled for May 11th. He will be held without bond until he is remanded to the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections. The Class X guidelines for attempted first-degree murder are 6 to 30 years in prison plus 25 years to life for an enhancement for personally discharging a firearm. The sentence will be served at a minimum of 85%. The additional charges of aggravated battery with a firearm causing great bodily harm and aggravated discharge of a firearm will not contribute to additional prison time for the defendant because Smith was convicted of the primary charge. Smith shot a 30-year-old truck driver at about noon on July 28th in the South Alley behind Smith's residence in the 2000 block of East William Street. The shooting victim testified that he went to meet Smith to resolve a dispute arising from Smith staying overnight at his ex-wife's house while the victim's two young children also resided there. The victim testified that his 4-year-old daughter told him Smith had been in bed with her and her mother. The victim said he discussed the matter with Smith, but Smith would not agree to stay away from his children. Smith did not testify at his trial. In her closing argument, Assistant Macon County State's Attorney Lindsay Sheldon said Smith tried to kill the victim by shooting a bullet which entered his chest. It was an "I want to kill you" shot, Sheldon told the jurors Thursday morning. He kept shooting until he emptied the entire magazine. She said everything the victim said during his testimony was corroborated by other evidence, including testimony by his ex-wife, cell phone evidence in the exact location where the spent shell casings were found by officers in the alley. Reuter passionately, loudly argued that Smith was not the shooter. He said the victim was uncertain of which face to pick out of the photo lineup while he was in the hospital shortly after the shooting. Reuter said the victim was looking to pick Smith's face out of the photo lineup, not the person who actually shot him. "I don't know who shot him," Reuter said. "I really don't care." Shelton argued that the victim did not have his glasses with him at the hospital. He was wincing in pain. He was drugged by morphine and upset because he didn't know what Smith, who was still at large, might do to his children, despite his uncertainty. He did finger Smith. "It was only reasonable. He was only 50% sure," Sheldon said. He never wavered from saying who shot him. Reuter also argued that the victim might not have been shot at all. He might have been injured by a piece of metal when he jumped over the fence as he ran from the scene. A doctor had testified that the victim still had a bullet lodged in his chest wall, which doctors decided to leave inside the body for medical reasons. Shelton said Smith brought a gun to a fist fight. The two men did not like each other, and the victim was not going to give up on the idea of preventing Smith from spending time around his children. He was going to make things simple and just get rid of him, Shelton said. Shelton said that there was much more substantial evidence that pointed to Smith as the one who shot the victim. In response to Reuters' assertion that cell phone evidence showed that Smith was innocent because he was receiving and making calls before and after the shooting, Shelton said the evidence showed... that the opposite was true. From 12:01 to 12:04 p.m., Smith was apparently not talking on his phone. "You've got 3 minutes of time for the victim to pull up and say, 'Are we going to do this?' Park and get out of the car and have the defendant empty his clip," Shelton said. Smith had 4 other prior felony convictions and has served 3 terms in prison. He was sentenced to 6 years in 2006 in a narcotics case, 4 years in 2009 for a felon possessing a weapon, and 4 years in 2011 for attempted unlawful use of a weapon, all in Macon County cases. In January 2016, he was convicted of being an armed habitual criminal in a Cook County case, for which he was sentenced to 30 days in jail, according to a court document. Ex-pastor charged with sexual assault, abuse, Decatur. Jose Luis Aboides, a former pastor of a church in the city's east side, was charged Thursday in Macon County Circuit Court with 7 felony counts for allegedly, repeatedly sexually assaulting and abusing a girl younger than 13 during a period of 7 months. Aboides, 58, who was being held in the Macon County Jail on $250,000 bond, is facing 1 count of predatory criminal sexual assault, punishable by 6 to 60 years in prison, 2 counts of criminal sexual assault, and 4 counts of aggravated criminal sexual assault. The victim told police she attended the Palabra Mille Hispanic Church at 3434 East Wabash Avenue, where Aboitiz began to sexually abuse her in an office in the church about September 16, 2015, said a request for an arrest warrant by Decatur Police Detective Eric Ethel. Aboitiz was listed as a pastor slash elder of the church and in the court document. The victim said the abuse began with Jose touching her leg and progressed to sexual intercourse, said the court document. The victim said that during choir practice, Jose would call her to his office, where he would fondle and abuse her. She reported that the abusive conduct occurred during a period of several months. The adolescent girl told police that she took numerous cell phone photographs of her naked body and sent them to Jose's phone. Detectives received more than 10 letters from the girl in which Aboitiz expressed his love for the victim. In addition to knowing her age, Ethel wrote in the court document, Aboitiz frequently asked the victim to destroy the letters after reading them. An intellectually disabled teen girl also reported to police that she'd been abused by Aboitiz, said the warrant request. She said Aboitiz would call her into his office, hug her, and fondle her on top of her clothes. She told detectives that Jose told her not to tell her parents about the conduct. In a July 2010 story in the Decatur Herald and Review, it was reported that Aboitiz, who was originally from Mexico, was then serving as the assistant to the church's founder, the Reverend Alberto Diaz. The article reported that Aboitiz was leading the congregation in song during a worship service. A family that was cleaning the one-story church building Thursday afternoon confirmed that Aboitiz was an assistant pastor at the church, but is no longer on the church's staff. When Diaz was contacted by phone, he said that he did not want to discuss Aboitiz with the Herald and Review. Aboitiz is due in court March 24th. For his arraignment and to present his attorney. NCAA tourney fans take a break for Christmas. Basketball Christmas begins at local bars, Decatur. Friends Alex McCready and Matthew Edwards were finally exactly where they wanted to be Thursday afternoon. There have been plenty of years in which the two, both from Decatur, had to either work or go to school while what WSOY 1340 AM afternoon show host Eric Lee calls Basketball Christmas. The first day of the NCAA tournament unfolded with its upsets, buzzer beaters, and memorable plays. But this year, McCready had the day off from his job as general manager at Culver's, and Edwards was off for spring break from Illinois State University. They met at Lock, Stock, and Bagel for lunch, and a day of college basketball. Most of the time, I just try to take breaks and watch the games on my phone, but I actually have the next 2 days off, so I can actually enjoy it, McCready said. Neither said they'd ever skip school or work to watch the tournament. I've taken some longer breaks, but never skipped, McCready said. Lee's show, the Eric Lee Show, recently moved from WDZ 1050 AM, on which Lee had hosted a sports show since 2008. The new show is community-based, covering local news, current events, and entertainment, but Lee's roots are still in sports. He found a way to combine old and new by broadcasting his show from Lock, Stock, and Bagel on Thursday and today, something this old show has done for several years. The view from the table where Lee's equipment was set up with an 80-inch projection screen with the games on. Even though the format of my show has changed, the relationships we have, like with Lock, Stock, and Miller Lite through Mueller Distributing, allow me to continue to be part of one of my favorite times of the year, Lee said. No matter what the format of my show, I'm still a sports guy, and we won't be afraid to create new events around sports. The biggest draw for the tournament is the brackets fans fill out and enter in pools. There were no major upsets early on the first day of the tournaments, other than Middle Tennessee State and a 12-seed upsetting 5th-seeded Minnesota. McCready didn't fill out a bracket this year and didn't want doesn't have a particular team he roots for, but he enjoys the wall-to-wall games and drama of the tournament's first two rounds. Edwards did fill out a bracket, but lamented the University of Illinois not being in. "I don't have a favorite team since the U of I started falling off in the past few years," Edwards said. "My bracket started out well, but I had East Tennessee State beating Florida." J.B. Hinton of Decatur, sitting at the bar at Locals 101 watching the games, was also disappointed to be watching a tournament without Illinois for the fourth straight year. "I'm a diehard Illinois fan," said Hinton, who has Kansas beating Arizona in the championship of his bracket. "It's too bad we can't watch Illinois be in it today, but it's still basketball. This is a tradition for me. Every year I go somewhere to watch the games." In local news on page 3, Decatur Town Hall laments school funding woes. Meridian High School has a brand new building and began the school year with a budget in the black. Yet 3/4 of the way into the school year, the district has yet to receive a transportation payment from the state of Illinois, and that has put the budget $300,000 in the red. How do you compensate for $300,000 you thought was going to be in the budget that isn't there? Said Eric Hurlbrink, principal of Meridian. As father of two children in the district, he said he has to consider that the decisions he makes affect not only his own kids, but all the other students as well. At a town hall meeting at Stephen Decatur Middle School on Thursday, State Senator Andy Menard, Democrat of Bunker Hill, talked about the inequities in school funding in Illinois and how the situation is getting worse. "Over the past 5 fiscal years, we have increased spending on K-12 grants by $1.3 billion, and every year the metric of inequity has gotten worse," he said. State Representative Sue Shearer, a retired teacher who has worked closely with Menard on school funding reform measures, said that a wealthy district north of Interstate 80 is considering adding lanes to the school swimming pool, while a downstate school in a poor district hasn't had a new textbook for 15 years. "We've been fighting about this since 1978 when I started teaching," Shearer said. Menard said school funding inequity is built into the law, and the only solution is to dispense with the use of property taxes. "The same law has been in use since 1997, he added, "and times have changed significantly since then." A bill is pending in the legislature that isn't the radical bill he and Shearer had proposed in the past, but a compromise that will eventually fix the problem. Rafaela Prang, who works at Millikan University, said she attended the town hall meeting because she sees the effects of inequitable funding on college students. "The ones who have come from wealthy districts have a distinct advantage over the ones who don't. I've been watching Andy fight this for years," said Fred Spanaus, a Decatur school board member. "There's no more important fight than school funding." Teacher Hannah Leiberger, mathematics department chair at Eisenhower High School, said that as a teacher, she's a surrogate mom to 160 students as well as being a mom to her own kids, and she sees the difficulty of working with limited resources every day. "I'm the one who has to look into your child's face and say no," she said. "I get as creative as I can, but sometimes it's not enough." City Councilman Patrick McDaniel said that one problem with bringing change was evident at the meeting, which was attended by about 30 people. "Where are the parents?" he said. He had hoped for a larger turnout. Prang said a group is working together to fix the problem by training parents in civics and engagement with government bodies. An organizational meeting is planned for 6 p.m. Sunday, April 2nd, at the Decatur Area Arts Council. The hope is that with training, parents will become more willing to be involved and let their voices be heard, she said. Sparks fly as Decatur Township eyes decreased budget. The Decatur Township is looking at a smaller budget for next year. A new $2.22 million budget was unveiled during the township special meeting on Thursday night, though no action was taken. The budget outlined would be down from the current $2.3 million budget, The budget proposal will be discussed at the board's next regular meeting on April 5th, when changes could still be made. The board must approve a tentative budget and have it displayed to the public for at least 30 days before it can vote to make the spending plan official. Most of the night was taken up by arguments related to long simmering animosity between Assessor Vicky Sheets and Trustee Tom Grianius, who previously served as assessor from 2009 to 2013. Sheets proposed a budget of $462,700, a reduction of more than $2,000 from her current budget. But Grianius repeatedly talked about how the budget was less during his tenure and suggested the office tentatively be cut by $133,214. Under his plan, Sheets would have to justify why she needed more money for operations. The suggestion upset Sheets and several trustees, as cuts would likely lead to layoffs within the office. Sheets said her budget request was needed due to the years of mismanagement. If you, the board, agree with these cuts, then you are pitiful, Sheets said. If other assessors, including Grianius, did their jobs, then we wouldn't need so much staff. The unsubtle dig was in reference to Grianius' tumultuous tenure as assessor, which saw the county required to step in and perform the quadrennial assessment and regular arguments at township meetings, where trustees told Grianius that he failed in his job duties. He has maintained he did do his job, but was not given the money necessary to operate the office. After nearly an hour of tense discussion, which required several points of order, teetering on turning into a shouting match, the board decided to accept the budget numbers presented by Sheets. It also wanted to get a report on how money is spent in the office and how to discuss it at the board's next meeting. Supervisor Lisa Stanley said after the meeting that the report was not to further prod Sheets, but merely something she hopes to see done by department heads. "I feel they should just explain how they're spending money," she said. WEIU frequency not sold at auction, Charleston. The mystery of the WEIU broadcast station status in the Federal Communication Commission's auction that started last year has lifted, and it has revealed that the station's frequency was not auctioned. The FCC auction, which gave broadcast stations across the country the opportunity to sell their frequency to make room for more cell and Wi-Fi signals, is the higher frequencies, is in its final stages, and Jack Neal, WEIU-TV general manager, said while Eastern did enter, WEIU's frequency was not auctioned. As previously reported, the FCC only needs a certain amount of the frequency spectrum for the cell and Wi-Fi signals and will be very selective as to which frequencies they might want. Neal said that WEIU has a good high-frequency channel, but is geographically not as favorable as a station in New York City, for instance. Because the station's frequency was not auctioned, WEIU will be dropped to a lower frequency. However, Neal said that there will likely not be a noticeable difference for viewers. When this finally happens and things are completed in the next few years down the road, viewers will have to hit the scan button on their TV once, Neal said, and it will essentially be invisible to viewers. Despite this, the station's future is still uncertain because of President Donald Trump's proposed budget plan, which seeks to eliminate funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that funds local public broadcast and radio stations like WEIU. CPB is a private nonprofit corporation created by Congress in the 1960s that formed PBS and NPR shortly after. Neal said that this proposed budget item Should this budget item pass, it would destroy public television like WEIU. Neal said that there would be no way to replace the federal funding the station gets, and everything would likely be shut down. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated March 17th, 2017. Now, this is Barbara Ridenour. Please stay tuned.